At the age of 90, John Freely has written of his adventures in war, science, teaching, and world travel in a memoir from Knopf called The House of Memory, Reflections on Youth and War. Mr. Freely is the author of over 60 other books on topics ranging from biographical figures to the history of science, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show now. Welcome here, and you braved this terrible weather.
No, I used to get a quarter of an hour shoveling sidewalks in New York for this.
During the Depression when...
See, we were aspiring working class. I once asked my mother, are we working class? So you would be working class if your father could find work.
Yes, and that was after you say you heard Roosevelt mention that in one of his fireside chats. He talked about the working class. Your mother said if we only were working...
We were aspiring working class.
You say it's taken you a long time to write this memoir, which you originally imagined writing 70 years ago. There have been an awful lot of books in between. I wonder how you've written
I spent age 5 to 7 in the Dingle Peninsula in the west of Ireland. My 4 grandparents, only one could read and write. And one of my distant kinsmen, Morris O'Sullivan, wrote a book called... 20 Years of Growing. He couldn't speak English. He couldn't read or write. It was taken down and published in Irish and English. And 20 Years of Growing, 20 Years of Blossom, 20 Years of Stoop, and 20 Years Declining. Such is the life of man. So when I first read that, I thought, I will do the same thing. And when I, the first form that it took, when I just came back from the war, a month before my 20th birthday, I said, I will start doing the book. So it marinated all through the years. And then I finally... finished it quite a few years ago, and nobody was interested, so I put it away in a filing cabinet. Now, what's his name? Arthur Kessler once said, a writer's unpublished manuscript in a filing cabinet is a writer's equivalent of a corpse under the floorboard.
So finally opened up the floorboards and...
Well, actually, I got in touch with a wonderful agent, Gillian McKenzie, and she said, what do you have? Well, I said, I've got it. So I took it out and whacked it a couple of times. The dust came out of it, and we straightened it up, and... the business of memory. Memory is a very strange thing because you don't want the present seeping into the past at all. And, of course, Schopenhauer said that we sort of craft our memories to create our identity.
So were you surprised by some of the things you found when you looked at that manuscript?
No, actually, because I've been going over it in my head for years and years.
Well, let's go back. You were born in Brooklyn in 1926. How long after your parents had moved to the United States?
Well, actually, my mother and father were Irish immigrants who met, married, and conceived me in Boston. And then when she was fired, they took me down to New York, and my father got a job as a trolley car conductor on the Canarsie-Williamsburg Bridge Line. And my mother tells me she used to take, on a nice day, he'd ring his bell, and she'd take me out, we'd ride to the Williamsburg Bridge and back again. But I don't remember that. We left America when I was 4 and a half. I have no memories of America. So I'm growing up in an Ireland place where they're speaking a different language.
The Dingle Peninsula in Ireland. And you say that almost everyone didn't speak English. They were all speaking Gaelic?
They were all speaking Irish. And hardly anyone. In fact, my maternal grandmother could speak English, but my grandfather, too, he couldn't read or write. So it was completely... everything was based on memory.
But your grandfather, Thomas Murphy, is still known on the Dingle Peninsula as Tom of the Winds because he was such a great storyteller. So that was one of your inspirations, the other being some of the books you found in your grandparents' attic?
Well, my great-grandfather had fought in the Crimean War. He couldn't read or write, but he got a book of gravures. It was called A Pictorial Voyage Around the World, a voyage up to Limpopo, a voyage across the American West by rail. And so that put the idea in my head of traveling, particularly to Constantinople.
Yeah, you have taught in Istanbul, Constantinople used to be, for 50 years.
I was still teaching there a year and a half ago.
Wow.
History of science, physics, astronomy.
How did you wind up there as an English speaker who may know some Irish?
Well, because I had wanted from the time I was a child. He had been there in 1856 during the Crimean War, so I thought, I want to go there. So anyway, when I came back from the war, I had dropped out of high school to join the Navy. And after the war, we were all engaged in self-destructive activities. So I met this very beautiful girl, and I thought, my God, I've got to do something. So I went to college on the GI Bill and then...
Iona,
yeah.
And then you went to, what, NYU?
Well, actually, I didn't. I got a job as a research physicist at the U.S. Army Signal Corps Laboratory. I was right in the middle of the McCarthy era. And then a job at Princeton, meanwhile going to graduate school at NYU at night.
Now, okay, let's back up again. You were in Ireland. How did you return to the United States? Mostly living in Brooklyn?
Well, everything was Brooklyn because my father, at times, he was a trolley car conductor, longshoreman, and manual laborer. Anyway, so he finally...
he was a grave digger for part of the time to make a living.
Yeah, all of his life, yeah. But the thing is that he got a job, and then we came back from Ireland, and by the time we got back, he'd lost the job, so he had to turn around and go back again.
And your mother, you say, worked nights cleaning offices in Rockefeller Center.
Yeah, right.
And you, when you, by the time you were in high school, well, first you went to parochial school, but then you went to Brooklyn Tech.
Brooklyn Tech, yeah.
And you were delivering the Brooklyn Eagle. You worked after school and on Saturdays in a paint factory, and then as a stock clerk in a drug supply factory. And you sold, among other things, packaged condoms. Good Catholic boy? Was it because your mother was an atheist?
I was a third-generation atheist. We packaged them, but we didn't actually see them. But the thing is that my principal source of income was scavenging, rag and bones and so forth. It was wonderful.
And bring them to the junkyard?
I'm sorry?
What were you scavenging them for, to sell?
To sell them for junk. We got 2 cents a pound, on 2 cents a 100 pound on papers and brass and copper and broken down radios and so forth. And sometimes, those nice old brownstone houses you go by and the doorknob would be a little loose. You'd take it and put it away.
So that lasted until the end of the Depression.
Well, actually, the Depression for us never quite ended.
So is that why you enlisted in the U.S. Navy in 1944 when you were just 17?
Yeah, well, see, the thing is, I was because I was working nights and weekends, I couldn't keep up with my studies. The only course I passed was literature. The idea was that I was fixated by Homer. So I thought if I can get in the Navy, I might go across his tracks. And I did quite a bit.
And you say you were afraid that the war would end before you got a chance to enlist. So Homer and other things led you to romanticize the war. But then you didn't find the war to be all that pleasant. In fact, you describe war as hell on earth.
Well, I'd say my war was very interesting because I was in an elite commando unit. It was not attached to the Chinese army. It was a clandestine army of Chinese soldiers, 100,000 of them. They accounted for more Japanese than did Mao or Chiang Kai-shek. And it was called the Loyal and Patriotic Army of China. And there were 100,000 troops, but most of them were for the Tibetan borderlands of China. They couldn't speak Chinese at all. They're from matrilineal societies.
So you wound up near Tibet?
Up in Yunnan province, yes.
Now, you said Mao and Chiang Kai-shek. Were you aware of that this was kind of the lead-up to the Chinese Civil War?
Well, actually, I was involved in the first day of the Chinese Civil War, because when the war ended on the 2nd of September 1945, I was all by myself in the headquarters of the Chinese First Army Group, and myself and my companion Ching Ying Chu, we celebrated the end of the war, and then about 2 hours later, we had machine gun bullets bursting through our tent. It was the Chinese Civil War had just started. We're in the middle of it.
What was your journey along the Lido-Stillwell Road like?
It was quite extraordinary because when we went from San Pedro, California to Calcutta by way of Australia, and then they put us in trucks in Calcutta, and we went on barges of the Assam Railway all the way up to the within sight of Tibet, and then down through along the Burma Road, along the Salween River, just as the great battle of the Salween Gorge is finishing. There were 120,000 Chinese and Japanese troops have been killed in that war. Mm. We caught just the last day of it.
And you passed through a military cemetery while you were in the Navy.
Actually, just exactly when we went on the Burma Road, we passed a cemetery, and a black sergeant said, well, that was this...
And that was a shocker to you?
A shock. Well, my father's a gravedigger, so I'm used to people being buried and put footstone. They were just dumping those poor young men in the grave.
While you were on watch one night, you heard a young Japanese soldier crying or yelling.
Well, actually, we were put on guard duty. It was in Mong Yu, the last day of the Battle of the Salween River Gorge, and myself and my friend Gene Tunney, spaced about 50 yards apart, and between us was...
Not the G. Tunney, the boxer.
Well, actually, he was a Gene was from... Gene Tunney used to box at his father's farm,
uh-huh.
So that's where the name came from. But anyway, and between us was a Kashin scout. The Kashins, when they kill a Japanese, they cut his right ear off. And so halfway through our watch in the middle of the night, I heard a screaming to my left, and then I heard this gurgling sound. He had cut his throat, and the next morning we found it was just a 17-year-old emaciated kid. So a great shock. But then we... about some time, a week or two later, we were marooned by the monsoon. And I was put out, a convoy was strung out for many miles, and I was put out on the road with a flashlight to wave people into the Chinese army camp. And then finally, to protect myself, I rolled under the truck. And next morning I wake up, somebody's nudging me from under the tailgate of the truck, and a big black American quartermaster sergeant says, "Wake up, soldier, the war's over."
You're listening to New York Public Radio at WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope, speaking to John Freely, whose book, The House of Memory, Reflections on Youth and War, is published by Knopf. You mentioned that you had been inspired by Homer, by the Odyssey. Did you think of yourself when you started traveling all over the world as a kind of a modern-day Odysseus?
Well, actually, by all means, yes. And in my life, I published a book on Homer about 3 years ago. I have been everywhere that Homer, that Odysseus was, including, in fact, I read Homer before I went to war, but I read it in the Richard Chapman's translation of 1597. And on the way back from the war in China, we went the other way around, and we passed through the Suez Canal and then out into the Mediterranean. And we passed the southern tip of Crete, and I remember this wonderful line from Homer by Chapman: "In the middle of the sable sea there lies an isle called Crete, a ravisher of eyes."
Mm.
So,
well, you've written over 60 books.
Yeah.
How did you have time to travel and write books at the same time?
Well, because I was living in Istanbul, but we also lived in Athens. We also lived in Venice. But we, in those days, travel was very cheap, and we traveled with our children. You know, hotels were $2-3 a night. And
now, you mentioned that you went to college. You got postdoctoral work at All Souls College in Oxford after you went to NYU. And you studied nuclear physics. How did that come out of all these experiences?
Well, I was always interested in science, but my PhD is in physics, but at Oxford I studied history of science.
And you also tell the sad story that your wife, Dolores, who you call Toots, died on your wedding anniversary?
On 64th wedding anniversary, yes.
Wow. Now, they've named a building after you at Bosphorus College in Istanbul.
It's the John Freely Cultural Center. It's a very funny story about it. When I was 80, they renamed my lecture room the John Freely Seminar Room. And a friend of my daughter's from Harvard, Alkis Doxiadis, came through, and a young graduate student woman met him at the airport, and she said, "I'm hoping to see John Freely." And she said, "Oh, sir, John Freely is not a person, it's a room."
You've divided this memoir into three sections, Youth, War, and Memory. But the title is House of Memory. What do you think of as the House of Memory?
Well, see, the Greeks, the Irish have a memory as a pool of memory. And you dip in the pool, things up. The Greeks being more organized, to remember things, you remember this room goes love and that room goes sadness, and memories you really want to bury, you put down in the basement and lock the door. All my life I've been fascinated by memory. There are books called The Palace of Memory, The House of Memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been fascinated by how memory your memory of things changes over time.
Well, you're 90 years old. There are some things that just have to have been lost over the years.
Not at all. I don't think I've ever...
You can recall pretty much everything?
I have no delete button in my brain.
Well, it's all there in everybody's brain. It's just harder for some people to bring it back.
Well, mostly because they don't get into it. But once you see, living in a nursing home now, my average age is 90.
You're in Bath, in England?
In Bath, yes. And I'm developing a relationship now with a 93-year-old lady. It's not going far because we're both kind of deaf. But they have not re-examined their memories. I've been re-examining my memories all my life. And, you know, people say...
Because you've been writing. And the writing kind of makes it permanent for you?
Well, that's right, because then it gets fixed, and then I don't have to think about it anymore. But the thing is that I've done 5 books since I've been in the nursing home because I have nothing else. I have no day job now. But people say, are you Irish? Are you American? I'm from Brooklyn. That's my identity was formed.
Do you ever go back?
In 66 years, I have not been back, and I'm hoping to go with this damn snow maybe tomorrow.
Because you'll find it's changed a lot.
Oh, I will, yeah, indeed. You know, I had a dear friend once, about 5 years older than me, a very prominent Jewish scholar from my part of Brooklyn. I said, have you been back? He said, I'd be terrified to meet my 17-year-old self.
Yeah, me too. I grew up in Williamsburg.
Where did you grow up?
I actually lived on Broadway with the elevated train going by in Williamsburg.
Oh, of course. I know the Broadway L was wonderful.
Yeah. Still there.
Oh, yeah, but you were in Williamsburg, yeah.
Yeah, and moved all around the borough. But that's when I write my book. I'll write a memoir someday. But everyone should know that you will be reading from your book and signing tomorrow night at 6 at the Corner Bookstore on Madison Avenue and 93rd Street. The book, The House of Memory, Reflection on Youth and War, published by Knopf. It's been a great pleasure having you here, and considering the hardship of getting here and in this terrible weather, I really do appreciate being able to see you and talk to you face to face.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Yeah.